Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks, Zhongcheng, for the very nice introduction. And today, I'm going to talk about some strongly correlated topological materials. Let me start by thank my collaborators. Mengxin is my student, and I also like to thank Maxim, Victor, and Pierre Skolman. On the experimental side, I would like to acknowledge my colleague at Michigan, Jim Allen, Lu Li, and Charlie Ankodak. And also, I would like to acknowledge Zach Fesk and UC Irvine. So most of the topics discussed today can be found in this recent preprint. But I will also mention some conclusion in early theoretical collaborations, as well as collaborations with my experimental colleagues. OK, so this is a brief outline. So I will first give a brief review about this material, Sommerian hexaboron, and also about heavy fermion compounds. Then I will try to demonstrate to you that this material is actually a topological condo insulator. In addition to that, this material is also a topological crystalline condo insulator. And in the last part, I will discuss recent experimental progress. Okay, so this material, SMB6, is not a new material at all. It's actually one of the first strongly correlated material ever studied. This is one of the mixed valence band, a mixed valence material. And this is the first paper. And you can see the first study comes in the late 60s. And in the first paper, one of the quantities these three authors measure is the resistance and the function of temperature. And as we can see, when temperature reduces, there is this very nice exponential curve, the resistance increasing exponentially. So this exponential increase comes from thermal excitation. It means we have a bulk band gap, so this material should be an insulator. But what I want to emphasize to you here is this plot, they only showed the data above 4 Kelvin. Okay? They have measurements at a lower temperature, but they didn't show it in this plot. In the text, they said if we go below 4 Kelvin to 3 Kelvin, we find that this exponential increase actually stops. Okay? So this is another plot measured in the 70s. In this plot, we can see the same exponential increase, but if we go below 4 Kelvin, it starts to saturate. So later in the 80s, 90s, and after 2000, people go to even lower temperature. And if one go below 3 Kelvin, one can really see a plateau. The resistance is almost a constant, temperature independent. So this transport plot is pretty interesting because if you look at the high temperature part, it looks like we have an insulator. If you look at the low temperature part, you find this is actually a conductor, not an insulator. So whether this material is a metal or an insulator, this has been a central focus of lots of debates in the 70s. So until the late 70s, first metallic picture is ruled out. This is definitely not a metallic material. This measurement comes from the Hall effect. We know that if we measure the Hall conductivity, we can get the carrier density. If we have carrier density and we have resistivity, we can estimate the mean free path using the very simple Joule formula. If we use the Joule formula to estimate the mean free path for this material at low temperature, the mean free path is dramatically smaller than the lattice spacing. It means one will need hundreds or thousands of impurity in each unit cell to explain this transport data. That's impossible. So since this is not metal, it must be an insulator. And how can an insulator have conductivity? The simplest picture is maybe some impurity bands, impurity contribution. This is also very unlikely because we know if it comes from impurity by improving the quality of the sample, making better and better sample, eventually we should be able to get rid of this low temperature conductivity. However, people tried very, very hard, tried many, many methods to try to get rid of the low temperature conductivity. It's always there. And in addition, people carefully estimated the Mott limit for this material. And it can be found that the Mott limit is about, the impurity density is about 10 times smaller than the Mott limit. It means the impurity number is not enough to form an impurity band. So it's pretty unlikely, the conductivity pretty unlikely comes from impurity. So because the low temperature conductivity is so robust, and in addition, there are some other experimental results I will not have time to mention. In the 90s, this author comes with a new possibility. This suggests maybe this is an insulator, but the low temperature conductivity probably comes from some intrinsic contribution instead of impurity.
Okay. So as you increase the quality of sample, how does the residual
Actually, this is another mystery in the 70s. If I measure different sample, there is a huge sample dependence, the low temperature conductivity. It means if I get the same sample from the same group, same method group of sample, the conductivity can change by one or two order of magnitudes. That's something not understood in the 70s. So it varies a lot. And that's actually, I'll come back to this later. It's actually a good supporting evidence for the surface conductivity, because one can control the bulk quality, but no method can control the surface quality. The surface quality depends on luck. Even the same group cannot guarantee the surface is the same for different sample. Okay, so this is proposed, you know, the low temperature conductivity may come from intrinsic. But how can an insulator have intrinsic conductivity? That's something never understood. So this is an incomplete list about heavy fermion insulators and condor insulators. But nevertheless, these open questions remain for many, many years. So to understand the low temperature transport data, it turns out we need to step back and thinking about a broader picture. So let's step back and thinking about generic heavy fermion compounds. So heavy fermion compounds is a large family of strongly correlated material. Experimentally, the basic signature is the Fermi liquid theory still works pretty well in most of these compounds. However, if we want to use Fermi liquid theory, we need to assume the effective mass of our quasiparticles is extremely large, about 100 times larger than the baryelectron mass. Theoretically, it can be described by using either the Anderson lattice model or the Condor lattice model. Here, I will use Condor lattice model to demonstrate the physics. So basically, in all heavy fermion compounds, we have a lattice. On each lattice site, we have a single spin on odd number of electrons. So these electrons cannot move. So they only have spin degree of freedom. On top of this spin lattice, we have conduction electrons. And those electrons can move. And they couple to this spin lattice through Condor coupling. At high temperature, the Condor coupling is weak. So this conduction band and this flat band, they almost don't talk to each other. By the way, this flat band comes from these localized electrons. Because they cannot move, the bandwidth is zero. There is no dispersion. This conduction band comes from this conducting electron. But if we go to the lower temperature, Condor coupling becomes stronger and stronger. Eventually, Condor coupling will introduce hybridization between these two bands. And after hybridization is introduced, a hybridization gap can be opened. If we have a gap, then there are two possibilities. One is a chem potential cross with one of the band. Now we have a heavy fermion metal. The other is a chem potential is inside the gap. Then we got a heavy fermion insulator. SMB6 belongs to this second family. So it's a heavy fermion insulator. Here I want to briefly mention why the electron mass is so heavy. By just looking at this figure, we find if we want to fit this band structure using k squared over 2n, because it's so flat, we need a very, very large mass. So that's why effective mass is so large. Of course, the detailed treatment is much more complicated because this is a strongly correlated material. We need to take into account all sorts of interaction effects. However, nevertheless, if we assume the heavy fermion materials still are described by the Fermi liquid theory, then at the end of the day, the low energy effective description can always be described using this type of simple band picture. Okay. Oh, here I want to mention another thing. For most previous study about heavy fermion compounds, people focus on metallic heavy fermion compounds. Insulating heavy fermion compounds are not studied, it's studied, but not as much as the metallic one. The reason is simple, because people try to find in heavy fermion compounds are unconventional superconductivities, spin charge ordering, et cetera. For those physics, metallic compound is much more useful. But for the insulators, for many years, because you know we believe insulator is trivial, so why should we pay attention to insulator if there is no electron can move? Recently, we know that in the last a couple of decades, we learned that insulators can actually be very non-trivial. It can be actually topologically non-trivial. So here, I briefly describe the basic phenomenon of topological insulator. We all know that it must be a bulk insulator, but the surface needs to be metallic. And this metallic surface is very robust, it's topologically protected. And if we want to destroy the metallic surface, namely, if we want to turn a topological insulator into a trivial insulator, we must destroy the bulk band gap. And on the, okay. Without conduction electron.
Extra doping.
So basically, we need a gap.
We need a band gap. So once you have a hybridization,
right,
then is there always a gap?
It's actually, it depends. It depends on the symmetry of the two band. Sometimes the symmetry of the two band allows you to open a full gap. Sometimes the symmetry prevents hybridization along some high symmetry lines. Then ZR1 will have some like a Dirac fermion. It depends. But for SMB6, it happens to be a fully gapped insulator. It depends on material, detailed material properties. Actually, this is the flat. So what I plot early on is a very simple picture. I'm plotting a 1D picture. But in reality, this is a 3D system. In a 3D system, you can do this 1D line, you know, in any direction. Along certain high symmetry direction in the Brillouin zone, because the symmetry is so high, if the two band happens to have opposite parity, symmetry, a different symmetry, then they cannot hybridize, they cannot open a gap. So this occasionally happens. This could happen. Sometimes it's a full gap. Sometimes there are nodes. This is just like P-wave pairing, PX pairing, D-wave pairing, and S-wave pairing. If it's you have S-wave pairing, then you have fully gapped system. If you have P-wave pairing, then you can have nodes. And this symmetry actually is determined by the symmetry difference between these two bands. If the symmetry of these two bands match, you can open a full gap. If not, then you can't. That depends on material. Okay. So since this is a theoretical talk, let me skip this introduction part about the topology. Everyone knows that. Okay. So since we know that insulators can be topological since the 80s, we can ask the question whether this condo insulator is, are they topological or not? Okay. And the answer is yes. And we named this type of states topological condo insulators. So here, instead of give you a calculation, instead of calculating the topological index, I will start from a cartoon picture and demonstrate to you the key ingredients to get a topologically non-trivial condo insulator. So here I will start from example. I assume I have a heavy fermion compound. So this is my flat band and this is my conduction band. I assume that these two different electrons, it happens to have opposite parity. So this is true for SMB6. For example, in SMB6, this flat band comes from the 4F state of Sumerian atom. We know that F state has odd angular momentum, so they have odd parity. To mark the odd parity, I put this minus sign here. That marks the parity. This conduction band for SMB6, it comes from the 5D electron. 5D, D is angular momentum 2. 2 is an even number, so it has plus 1 parity. So I use this plus sign to mark the parity of this D band. Okay?
So it's only defined
on the magnetic point. Right. In between, there is no parity symmetry. It's only defined at this high symmetry point. Yeah, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now because we have two bands, and let me assume there is no hybridization. Okay? If there are no hybridization, then we only have two possibilities. One is these two bands, they don't cross with each other. The other is they cross with each other, no other possibility. Okay? There is a marginal case. The marginal case is these two bands barely touch at some point. Now let me turn on hybridization. If I turn on hybridization, this guy, the first guy, the band structure changes a little bit, but the gap is still there if the hybridization is not that strong. So if the chem potential is in the gap, we find the insulator. Let me call this insulator 1. For the second case, if we introduce hybridization, we open up a hybridization gap. If the chem potential is inside this hybridization gap, we also get an insulator. We call this insulator 2. The interesting thing is the marginal case. For this marginal case, because this degenerate point has two states with opposite parity, a plus 1 parity of minus 1 parity, if we introduce hybridization, we cannot open up a gap here. They cannot hybridize due to the opposite parity. If they cannot open up a gap, then we know that if we want to turn insulator 1 to insulator 2, we always need to go through a gapless point. Okay? Because these two insulators have exactly the same symmetry. There's no symmetry difference. So this implies there must be some topological differences between these two insulators. They are two different, they have different topology. Insulator 1 is obviously trivial because this guy has fully filled D band, totally empty F band. Sorry for the other way. Fully filled F band, totally empty D band. So it's obviously a trivial insulator. This means this insulator 2 is non-trivial. Okay?
So these insulators
protected by the parity. It's protected by time, where so has parity.
No. Suppose you only have a parity, you will have this kind of
distribution. Right. Parity alone is enough.
It's enough to do this.
But you know, if I break the parity symmetry, the time reversal invariant, the time reversal symmetry protect topological structure is still there. One can show
is
that.
This argument
that
requires
parity.
Yeah.
But based on this argument, one can get the Z2 topological index. Once the Z2 topological index is there, if we break parity symmetry, one will still have the topological insulator. We still have the topological insulator. So this was one of. This was one of
Yes,
you are right. Yes. Oh, this one is a cubic lattice. It's basically the Sumerian anthem forms a cube. The six boron forms an octahedra stacked in the center of the cube, in the center of each cube. It's a very simple cubic lattice. The boron, the six boron, the state is far away from camp potential. They don't contribute. Only thing matters is this cubic lattice of Sumerian atoms. So you can think about it. You can think about it as a simple cubic lattice with Sumerian boron. You can ignore that. Okay. So this tells us. Let me summarize. Based on this picture, we know that to get a topological condo insulator, we need two ingredients. First, these two bands need to have opposite parities. And secondly, these two bands need to cross with each other. And this band crossing is known as a band invariant. Okay. Based on this picture, we calculated the Z2 topological index based on various models. And we find that by tuning the energy level of this flat band, we can get all sorts of different insulators, trivial insulators, strong topological insulator, weak topological insulator, et cetera. And based on this conclusion, we made two predictions in this paper. We predict that SMB6 is a strong topological insulator, and this serum-based compound and the weak topological insulator. Okay, so let me go back to SMB6. What is the topological structure of SMB6? Well, before we know the topological structure, we need to first understand what's the band structure of SMB6. But unfortunately, the answer is we don't know the band structure of SMB6, except for a couple of momentum points. So the question should be, can we get the topological properties by just looking at a couple of momentum points? We know that generically it's impossible because topology is a global property. Okay, we can only get the topology of a band by knowing the whole band structure, by knowing the wave function and every single momentum point. So however, if we have some symmetry protection, if we have some additional symmetry, actually the answer becomes yes. We can just look at this a couple high symmetry points, a couple special points to determine the topology. It turns out for SMB6, because of the very nice cubic symmetry, all the topological indices can be determined by just looking at this a couple momentum points. Let me give you the answer, and then I will come back to show you how did I get this conclusion. So if we look onto the 100 surface of Sumerian hexaboron, this is the surface boron zone, there would be three Dirac points. And these three Dirac points are protected by the time reversal symmetry. Two of them have the same energy due to symmetry. The other one have a different energy. If one look at the 110 surface, we still have three Dirac points, but they fall into two different categories. This disk is protected by the time reversal symmetry. That's the consequence of a strong topological insulator. These two squares mark surface Dirac points, which are protected by mirror symmetries. So these two guys are protected by the lattice symmetry. On the 111 surface, we have three Dirac points. They have the same energy located at the end point of the boron zone. They are all protected by the time reversal symmetry. So basically, the basic conclusion is there are two different types of surface Dirac points. Some of them are protected by the time reversal symmetry. Some of them are protected by the lattice symmetry. OK, so now let's look at the band structure of SMB6. So we don't know the band structure. That's why there are two big question marks here. But what we do know is there is one D band near the Fermi energy. In addition to that, there are four F bands near the Fermi energy. The D band is very simple because it has a huge bandwidth. All the band structure calculation gives the same result, roughly speaking, the same band structure for this D band. This D band for most part of the boron zone, it is above the chemical potential, above the Fermi energy. But at the X point, the energy is below EF. the three F bands is where the problem comes from. These three F bands, they have very similar energy. The energy is almost identical. So it's very hard to resolve these three F bands. We don't know, you know, how these three bands cross with each other, what the detailed band structure is, totally unclear. But one thing we do know is for most part of Brillouin zone, these three F bands, they are located below EF. Okay? Now, if we look at the X point, the story is slightly different. At the X point, one of the F band must be above EF. This is because this material is an insulator. If we have an insulator, the number of valence bands need to be fixed. So here we have three valence bands. If we ignore the lower energy states, here we have three valence bands. So at the X point, we must also have three valence bands. Because the D band now comes down, this means one of the F band must be pushed up. Otherwise, we can't get the insulator. So that's the key phenomenon here. So basically, the only feature we need is there are two bands, and they got inverted. And this two band has opposite parity. That's the only input we need on the experimental band structure side. OK, so for the experts in the audience, these are the symmetry labels for each of the bands. And they can be fully determined using space group symmetry. OK, so now let's try to compute the. So it's not.
There's the X is one band above,
uh-huh.
Gamma and M, all three below.
Oh, so in most part of.
This
gamma and most part of Brillouin zone, all the three bands are below the Fermi energy. This is, you know, we have very high confidence about that. So basically, if you measure optics and you find a very sharp J5½ sigma, it's this experiments. So for experiments, if one measure the optics, one find a very sharp J5½ peak. That J5½ peak means there are three bands slightly below the Fermi energy.
Band order can be detected by experiments.
Right. It's not band structure calculation. Actually, if one do band structure calculation, that's also what one find. So for band structure calculations, this detailed structure between these three F bands is different, totally different. And whether there is a gap or not is totally different, depending on the approximation you made. But if you do the band structure in the right way, one always find a very flat F band here. And experiments tell us this band is, these three bands are slightly below the Fermi energy, about 20 milli electron volts. And this D band, it comes from numerical band structure calculation first. But recently in ARPIS data, one rarely see this. Of course, ARPIS cannot see the other part, above the Fermi energy can't see. But one really sees there is one actual D band comes down. So this band structure, we have very high confidence about that. There are some small detail I didn't mention. There are some additional F bands here. But those F bands are always fully filled, so they don't matter. Okay. So close to Fermi energy, this is band structure. There's very little doubt about that. OK, so now let's try to compute the topological index. So instead of computing the topological index for SMB6, let me compare SMB6 with a trivial insulator. This trivial insulator is achieved by pushing the D band and the energy of the D band up and reducing the energy of the F band. So now the D band is always above the Fermi energy, F band is always below the Fermi energy. This is obviously a trivial insulator. Due to the cubic symmetry, the lattice have invariant symmetry. Since the lattice have invariant symmetry, we can use this techniques developed by Fu and King to compute the strong topological index. The left-hand side is mu is the topological index, the Z2 topological index. The right-hand side are the parity eigenvalues for all the valence bands and high symmetry points. We compute all those eigenvalues, multiply them together, and we got topological index. So here, instead of calculating this multiplication, I calculate the ratio between topological index of SMB6 over this trivial insulator. Okay. On the left-hand side, the denominator is 1, because trivial insulator has mu equals 0. It's trivial. On the right-hand side, the nice thing about this ratio is most of these eigenvalues, they cancel with each other. This is because, say, let's look at the gamma point. This trivial insulator and SMB6, they have exactly the same valence band. Because the band are the same, the eigenvalues must be the same. So they cancel with each other. And to the end of the day, the only thing that cannot get canceled are the eigenvalues of these two inverted bands. So we only need the eigenvalues for these two inverted bands. There is a power 3 here. This power 3 comes from the fact there are three x points in the Brillouin zone. Okay? Because these two inverted bands, they have opposite parity. One is D state, another is F state. This ratio must be minus one. Minus one power three is minus one. So the whole thing is minus one. So topological index is minus one. So this is a topological insulator. I will not go into details, but based on this same argument, we can determine the Dirac points protected by this Z2 topological index on the surface. And if we do that, we find the 1,0,0 surface time inverse symmetry protects three Dirac points. 1,1,0 protect one, 1,1,1 protect three. Okay? But this is not quite correct because there are two additional Dirac points along this KZ equals zero line. These two Dirac points, these two surface Dirac points are not protected by the time reversal symmetry. They are protected by the lattice symmetries. Actually, more precisely, they are protected by a mirror symmetry. So, so in this sense, this SMB6 is both a topological insulator. It has this Z2 surface state, and it's also a topological crystalline insulator. It has this lattice symmetry protect surface Dirac points. Okay, so how do we know there are lattice symmetry protect Dirac points? Let's go back to the quantum Hall effect. We know that in the quantum Hall effect, the topological index, the Chen number tells us the number of edge modes, chiral edge modes. Okay. Now let's consider a 2D system with horizontal mirror symmetry, with the implant mirror symmetry. Because the mirror symmetry, we can separate two different type of states. The state with mirror eigenvalue plus I, the state with mirror eigenvalue minus I. They cannot mix due to the symmetry. Okay. Since they cannot mix, we can define the Chen number for states with eigenvalue plus I, that's C plus, and we can define Chen number for minus I eigenvalue states, that's C minus. Because the whole system is time reversal invariant, the total Chen number must be zero. This means C plus and C minus must be the same number with opposite sign. So if C plus, this is a mirror Chen number, if it's non-zero, it means we will get some left-moving edge modes, and this left-moving edge modes has parity, mirror eigenvalue plus I. C minus is negative, it means that we will have right-moving edge modes, but with mirror eigenvalue minus I. This, the crossing point between these two edge modes will give me a Dirac point. And this Dirac point cannot be gapped because these two states have different mirror eigenvalue, so they cannot mix. So if mirror Chen number is non-zero, it tells me on the edge of my system, I will have Dirac points, okay? So for SMB6, if we want to calculate the mirror Chen number, we have two things need to be sorted out. First of all, this is a 3D system, not 2D. So this is actually very easy to solve. We can consider the KZ equals zero plane. KZ equals zero plane of SMB6 is a 2D system, and this 2D system has mirror symmetry, okay? Another problem is, again, we don't know the band structure. So we need to calculate the Chen number, but we cannot provide the whole band structure. Luckily, if we have rotational symmetry, say we have n-fold rotational symmetry, and then we can determine the Chen number up to mod n by just looking at the high symmetry point. This technique was first developed by Bernabeck and coworkers. And here is the formula. On the left-hand side, this is a Chen number or mirror Chen number. On the right-hand side, this etas are the rotational eigenvalues for four-fold rotations and gamma and m points. This ksi is a rotational eigenvalue, two-fold rotational eigenvalue for x points. If we multiply these things together, Bernabeck and co-workers told us this is the Chen number. But the same technique can be applied to calculate the mirror Chen number by just looking one of the mirror eigenvalues, by one of the mirror eigenstates. Okay, if we do this, actually what I did here is, again, I calculated the ratio between this SMB6 and this trivial insulator. Again, using the same trick, most of the eigenvalues on the right hand cancel. And to the end of the day, the only thing left is the ratio between the two eigenvalues for these two inverted bands. I only need to know the eigenvalues for these two inverted bands. And this ratio is universal. It's fully determined by the space group symmetry. And it must be minus one. So there is no, microscopic detail can never change this value. So this is very universal. This means the mirror Chen number is two. Mirror Chen number is two for KZ equals zero plane. For the KZ equals pi plane, which also has mirror symmetry, we can get mirror Chen number one. Okay. This means if we have MN zero surface, and to the KZ equals zero line, we should have two Dirac points because mirror Chen number is two. Along the KZ equals pi line, we should have one Dirac point because mirror Chen number is one. So let's look at the 1,0,0 surface first. And so the 100 surface, as we can see here, the KZ equals zero line, which is this line, has two Dirac points. Oh, by the way, these three dots are the Dirac points protected by the time reversal symmetry. That's the Z2 topological index, the Z2 topological surface states. If we look at the KZ equals zero line, we see two Dirac points. So time reversal symmetry already gave us these two Dirac points. This means this mirror Chern number don't give us any new information, okay, along this line. The KZ equals pi line, the time reversal symmetry tells us there is one Dirac point. Mirror Chern number also says there is one Dirac point. It means, again, mirror Chern number don't give us anything new. For the 110 surface, time reversal symmetry tells me there is only one Dirac point. Mirror Chern number tells me along pi, KZ equals pi, there is one Dirac point. Agreement is perfect. But for the KZ equals zero plane, mirror Chern number tells me I should have two Dirac points because mirror Chern number is two. But the time reversal symmetry tells me there is no Dirac points here. This means these two Dirac points are only protected by the lattice symmetry, not by the time reversal symmetry. Okay, so in this sense, there are two different categories of surface state in SMB6. Okay, the 111 surface and other high index surfaces, we prove that the mirror Chern number doesn't give you any new information. The mirror Chern number is only useful for the M and zero surfaces. Okay, so if we really believe SMB6 is topological insulator and the topological crystalline insulator, then this transport data becomes very obvious. It's very easy to explain. The high temperature part, this exponential increase, is definitely must be there because it's a band insulator. This gives me my bulk band gap. And low temperature, when the bulk becomes insulator, the surfaces, they are metallic. So this low temperature conductivity actually comes from the surface contribution. So this is an explanation, you know, we can offer if we believe it's a topological insulator. But is SMB6 really a topological insulator? When my experimental colleagues ask me this question, I know what they really want to know is another question. So can we really trust those theories? Okay, of course, and the theories we want to be trusted by our colleagues. But for strongly correlated systems, it's not always the case. Because strongly correlated systems are so complicated. It's very hard to make a precise and correct prediction. However, as I just demonstrated to you for this topological properties, it's totally microscopically independent, okay? Because it's so universal, so we have very high confidence about our prediction. But this is still not good enough to convince experimentalists. So my colleagues, very luckily, they decided that they will really test this prediction by doing an experiment. So this is an experiment setup my colleagues did. I want to emphasize what they measured are transport here. The techniques they used are not the standard technique to detect topological surface state. The reason is because for most previously studied 3D topological insulators, for bulk crystal samples, although it is a 3D topological insulator, but there are always some bulk conductivity for 3D crystal samples, for 3D bulk samples. Because there are bulk contribution, transport measurements, one need to be very careful. One need to deduct the bulk contribution from the surface if one want to measure surface conductivity. But in SMB6, as I will mention to you later, luckily we don't have this problem. There is no bulk conductivity. So the transport is very easy to pick out the, pick out the surface signal. So what my experimental colleague did is they have a pretty thin sample. This is the size. It's millimeter in size along X and Y. It's about 0.2 millimeter in thickness, okay? So on the top side, they put four contacts. On the bottom side, they also put four contacts, and the contacts almost align with each other. This geometry enables them to do some very fancy measurements. For example, they can pass the current vertically. If they pass the current vertically and measure the voltage here, for a bulk conductor, electron will tunnel through directly. Electrons like the shortest path. Okay, because electrons tunnel through directly, between these two contacts, there are no current, so there are no voltage. So this voltage will be almost zero for a bulk conductor. But if we have a surface conductor, electron can't tunnel through. The only thing electron can do is to go all the way around the sample and come back from the other side. Okay, in this geometry, this voltage will give you a huge number because there are lots of currents flowing there. Okay? So if we use, if I define the ratio between this voltage and this current, we find the resistance. This resistance, we call it R vertical because current is flowing vertically. So for bulk conductors, the prediction is this R vertical is almost zero. But for surface conductor, R vertical is very, very large. Another thing they can do is they can send the current in from the bottom and let current flow out from the bottom. If it's a bulk conductor, when you measure voltage on the bottom, on the top side, this two voltage will be the same because it's pretty thin. This two voltage will be the same. But if it's a surface conductor, electron will mostly flow on the bottom side because it comes in from the bottom and goes out from the bottom. If electron mostly flows here, the lower side will have a huge voltage, whereas the upper side will have a very small voltage. The voltage will be a big, there will be a big difference. Again, if we define the ratio, if we measure the voltage on the same side with the current, we call this ratio R lateral, which means current is flowing horizontally. If the voltage is measured on the other side of sample, we call it R hybridized. Hybridized means we use both bottom and upper side. For bulk conductor, these two quantities are the same. For surface conductor, these two quantities are very different. That's the prediction. And more precisely, we perform numerical calculations using geometry very close to the experiment. The left-hand side shows a bulk conductor. So here, what we assume is, we assume the conductivity has some funny temperature dependence. So the resistivity increases then saturate, and it's always bulk. That's what we assume on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we assume the topological picture. We assume there are two channels of conductivity. One is a bulk channel. This bulk conductivity dies exponentially at low temperature because there is a gap. And in addition, there is a surface conducting channel. That conducting channel, for simplicity, we assume the conductivity is temperature independent. And high temperature, because there are lots of bulk thermal excitations, we see bulk dominant feature. And low temperature, because the bulk dies, we see surface dominant feature. So this means at high temperature, our vertical is the smallest one, very, very small, almost zero. Our lateral and our hybridized are the same. But at the low temperature, because surface dominant, our vertical will change from the smallest one to the largest one. And our hybridized and our lateral will split. They will be different. That's a prediction. Okay. Now this is experiment. This is theory. This is experimental data. Okay. As we can see, the experimental data looks strikingly similar to the bulk surface crossover picture. It's totally different from the bulk transport picture. So in the bulk transport picture, if we calculate the ratio between any two of these resistances, the ratio is temperature independent. The reason is because for a bulk conductor, there is only one temperature dependence. That's temperature dependence of resistivity. For a cubic lattice, there is only one resistivity. So if we calculate the ratio, they always cancel. But if we have a surface to bulk crossover, this ratio will change by orders of magnitudes. And experimentally, if we calculate the ratio between two resistances, they change by five or six order magnitudes. This huge change cannot be explained by anything but a bulk to surface crossover. Okay, so based on this measurement, we can conclude very confidently. At high temperature, we have a bulk conductor. At low temperature, below about 3 or 4 Kelvin, we got a surface conductor. In addition, slightly afterwards, the UC Irvine group provided the Hall conductivity measurement. The Hall effect gave us carrier density. So what they find is at high temperature, the carrier density is proportional to the thickness of the sample, which means it's a bulk conductor. But at the low temperature, the carrier density is independent of thickness, which means it's a surface conductor. That's what they are concluding. It's totally consistent with my colleague's transport result. In addition, this surface state shows de Haas von Arfen oscillations. So if we increase magnetic field, we see this magnetization also oscillate dramatically. And this periodic structure means there are Fermi surfaces. And for an insulator, we observe Fermi surfaces. That's something very dramatic. And here I also want to emphasize de Haas von Arfen oscillation. Well, typically it measures magnetization as a function of magnetic field. Typically when one measures magnetization, one measures the bulk magnetization. Surface, because it's so thin, the contribution from the surface is very, very tiny. But my colleague Lu Li, he has a very wonderful spin torque technique, which has enough sensitivity to pick up magnetization on the surface. Okay? And using this very high resolution result, they really see this oscillation. And this oscillation indeed comes from the surface. To prove it comes from the surface, my colleague did this, tilted the direction of the magnetic field. For a surface metal, when we tilt the magnetic field, only the perpendicular component matters. It doesn't couple to the implant component. So one will have the frequency of this oscillation will fit 1/cosine phi, where phi is the tilting angle. And you can see it fits always almost perfectly. So this suggests that this oscillation comes from Fermi surfaces on the surface of our sample, not 3D bulk. And actually, he more precisely, he finds two different Fermi surfaces. One of them comes from the 100 surface. Another comes from the 110 surface. Okay. Yeah, that comes from angle-dependent measurements. In addition, more strikingly, Lu finds that both these two pockets contain Dirac points. Okay. The way to distinguish Dirac surface state and non-Dirac surface state is very simple. Because we know that quantum oscillation comes from, in 2D, it comes from Landau levels. For Landau levels, with Dirac points, we have integer n. Without Dirac point, we have n plus 1/2. Which we just need to distinguish this one and integer and integer plus 1/2. Now we can distinguish whether there is a Dirac point or not. That's exactly what he did. So the vertical axis here is the Landau index. So basically for the quantum oscillations, each value gives me a Landau level. We can label each Landau level using an integer. And this is my vertical axis, Landau index. Horizontal axis is inverse of magnetic field. By extrapolating this data using a linear function to an infinite magnetic field, one gets an intersection. If this intersection is a half integer, it means we have a Dirac point. If it's an integer, it means we don't have a Dirac point. And the Lully find is 1/2 with error bar about less than 10%. So it's very accurate 1/2 quantization.
So are you saying that EF lies directly at the
No. One don't need to assume EF located at the Dirac point. As long as there is a Dirac point, one will see this 1/2. The reason comes from, you know, if you want to fill this Landau levels in a Dirac system, then the Landau level and the Dirac energy, you know, if you start from half filling, you just need half of the electrons to fill that Landau level. That Landau level, you know, and half filling is already half filled because of particle symmetry. Then you just need half. That's the difference between the you know, when you first fill the first Landau level, you need half electron to fill the first Landau level. Then for any additional Landau level, you need an integer. So eventually to fill up one Landau level, you always need integer plus 1/2. That 1/2 comes from the zero energy Landau level. So this is an established technique. It has been used to study graphene and a weakly correlated topological insulator. And you know, they all have this feature and 1/2 intersection. Another way to understand this is a Berry flux, because the Dirac point gives you pi flux that shifts everything by 1/2. That's this 1/2 he saw. Okay. So this tells me we have metallic surface. Metallic surface has Fermi surfaces, and this Fermi surface contains Dirac points. So this means the surface state cannot come from some trivial effects like band bending. That will not give you a Dirac point. So in the last few months, there are several RPS papers. The data are more or less agree with each other. Up to resolution. Some of them have higher resolution, some of them have lower resolution. But the features are basically the same. Although the features are similar, but the interpretation from different groups are very, very different. So here, let me just, this figure comes from the first paper. Let me pick the first paper. So this is the 100 surface. For the 100 surface, theory prediction is there are three pockets, one and x, another and x prime, another and gamma. So the pocket under x and x prime can be resolved very clearly. You can see this sharp feature, this circle. This is another half of a circle. This is another circle. Okay, so there are two pockets there. It's very clear. The pockets under gamma, they see something here, but they cannot see a circle. This is because the Fermi wave vector here is very small. It's smaller than their momentum resolution. So they cannot resolve the sharp surface, but they do see something here. Okay. In addition, in this first paper, the authors changed the kz. Z is the momentum perpendicular to the surface. If you have a bulk state, by changing kz, the pocket size will change dramatically. Okay? But if you have a surface state, by changing kz, nothing will happen. And they changed the kz, and they find that this surface state, that this dark line here, it always remains the same. So this proves that this circle is really a surface pocket. That's from this RPS data. Okay, so basically, the RPS data tells me we have three pockets, same as our prediction, and the location is also.
How about the other papers? You said they claim different conclusions.
Right. So for example, this, I think the second to the last paper, they measured two different photon energy. Two different photon energy means actually they changed the two kz, and they find the figure looks different. So they claim it's a box state. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you pick this energy, this kz, and this kz, okay, it seems that indeed they are totally different. because here you see surface state, here you don't. But if you continuously go through, you know, each different KZ, you find that it's not the pocket shrinks and disappear. The pocket is always there, but just the intensity becomes lower because the overlaps of wave function become smaller. Okay, and again, there are some resolution type of problems. Different data have different resolution. So some of the data claim there is one actual pocket come from trivial effects. Some claim not. So that part hasn't been fully solved yet. But basically, the existence of these three pockets, precisely as theoretic prediction, is a good check of a theory. If the RPC is something different, then we were being in a big trouble. But the fact RPC is these three pockets exactly as what we predicted, that something means, you know, if I want an alternative theory, why would I need to, you know, really try hard to find an alternative theory? Okay, and in addition, quantum oscillation shows there are Dirac points. And if you know, if you combine all the theories, all the experimental signatures together to find the alternative explanation is, I would say, pretty hard. So every single experiment, one could find some alternative theory to explain it. But if one assumes that one alternative, you know, this one want to combine all the experiment data together, it will be very hard to disprove his topological insulator. I will say it that way. Okay, there are also some other experimental data, actually, and the numerical data. For example, numerical calculation, this paper says it's a topological insulator. It uses LDA plus Goose-Wheeler mean field. And UCLorin group doped this material using magnetic and non-magnetic impurities. Non-magnetic impurities don't do anything. The transport is almost the same. Magnetic impurity, as soon as they doped a little bit, the surface transport is totally destroyed. It becomes an insulator. This is another strong evidence of time reversal symmetry protected topological surface state. They only measured the 100. They didn't measure the 110. And for the 100, the mirror symmetry actually also have some Hamming contribution, but maybe they have, you know, surface you know, dislocation lines and something which break the mirror symmetry. It's not entirely clear how the mirror symmetry are not expected to be perfect. There are always impurities break the mirror symmetry, but how strong that effect gives us, you know, if we do the transform measurement, that's not very clear. Okay. In addition, weak anti-localization has also been reported, again, by the UCLorin group for the 100 surface. And STM data, and actually I forgot the list, I didn't list all the references here. STM, point contact, magnetoresistance all show signature about surface states. Okay. So let me summarize. On the experimental side, transport data tells us this material is a bulk conductor and high temperature, but it becomes a surface conductor below 5 Kelvin. And the surface transport is suppressed by magnetic impurities, and it shows anti-weak localization. In addition, I want to emphasize that the surface state is very, very robust if I don't dope magnetic impurities in that. For the last 40 years, people tried very hard to destroy this surface conductivity, but never find a way to do that. This robustness is another good indication of some protection, maybe topological. Okay. Of course, this quantum oscillation provides additional support to this topological picture. Quantum oscillation says Fermi surface from the Hausmann-Arfmann oscillations, and these surface bands have Dirac points. This Dirac points is another good indication. It's not some trivial effects. There must be something topological there. And RPs, you know, within the resolution, as you see, surface pockets, number and locations all agree with the topological theory. So combining all these experiments together, I think we have pretty good confidence, say, SMB6 is an ideal topological insulator. It has no bulk connectivity. For the topological crystalline condo insulator, theoretically, we know if it is a topological condo insulator, it must also be topological crystalline condo insulator. There are no debate about that on the theoretical side. But the experimental verification is still pending. One need to study the 110 surface with K-sensitive measurements. This hasn't been done yet. Okay, let me summarize. Hopefully, I convince you that this material is topological condo insulator. And hopefully I convince you this is also a topological crystalline condo insulator. And it seems that this material is ideal topological insulator because there are no bulk connectivity. Finally, I want to mention that this is not the only candidate. There is a long list of candidates. Some of them comes from myself and coworkers, and many of them comes from other groups. Okay, so let me stop here and thank you for your attention.
what happens at 4 Kelvin exactly?
Oh, so the 4 Kelvin is a crossover temperature. Basically, it's where the bulk and the surface each contribute 50% to the total conductivity.
But there's a claim that even above 4 Kelvin, you still have a
right.
TI.
It's still there. Just because thermal excitations, the bulk actually has some conductivity.
So there's no phase transition.
No phase transition. This is just a crossover.
It's pretty boring compound.
Right. There are no signature of phase.
No instability is of
no. No symmetry breaking. No any signature. I will not say it's definitely not. You know, we can never prove that. But in the last 40 years, no signature is has ever been reported for any symmetry breaking.
So what's the lowest temperature is that people?
I think probably 10 millikelvin or something, roughly speaking.
Using like NMR muons, we didn't see anything.
And there are no reported data, no any reported data. For mu m, let me mention another thing. For the SMB6 with no pressure, there are no phase transition. But for this heavy fermion compound, very typically, if you apply pressure, there could be something. And actually, for SMB6, if you apply pressure, one finds insulator to metal transition. That's transition in the bulk. And the reason is not entirely clear. We don't know whether it's because the bulk band gap closes, or it's because kinetic potential is shifted. That part is not clear yet. But experimentally, one can see if one applies pressure, the system becomes become a metal in the bulk. That part we know. And there are also data suggesting under very strong magnetic field, there is another metal to insulator to metal transition. But for just this crystal, I don't think there are any, at least there are no conclusive evidence saying there is a phase transition. Okay. And this transport data is definitely a crossover. Mm-hmm. It's just because one channel is exponential decay and the other channel is constant. So there is a point they cross. That's a crossover point.
So what is the size of the bulk gap?
The size of bulk gap is about 20 to 25 MeV. So the kinetic potential is not in the middle of the gap. The kinetic potential is close to the conduction band. So the kinetic potential to the conduction band is about 5 MeV.
Is that fixed? I think you can pull that easily.
In principle, yes. If you dope different, but for one sample, especially one sample from grown by the same grower, that value is pretty much fixed. It's probably because the impurity is
surface probably that. I don't know how you fix this.
It's probably bulk impurity. It's probably because there are some bulk impurity. And the impurity level pinned the time potential. It's not proved, but this is just one typical explanation. This is actually a typical effect for semiconductors and other type of insulators. Although in principle we know the time potential should be in the middle. But in reality, in many cases, it's not in the middle. It's shifted. And this shift is pretty.
Yeah, the main thing is that if there is no bulk impurity,
right.
But only surface effect.
I would expect the thickness dependence.
Yeah.
Because the carrier density from the surface is there, there should be a surface dependency. Right now, people study a very different sample with different thickness. There are no thickness dependence. So probably it's a bulk impurity contribution, I believe.
Plateau move back, like the edge of the plateau move back and forth a little bit with thickness?
In principle, yes, but that's kind of whole study hasn't been done for two reasons. One is because it's exponential decay. So it's a log, the shift is log. It's a log function of thickness, it's small. In addition to that, as I mentioned earlier on, there is a sample dependence. Different sample has very different surface quality. So sample dependence gives you a huge error bar, and you want to detect some logarithmic change in the huge error bar. This is very hard. This conductivity can sometimes change by order of magnitude, or even two orders of magnitudes. That's a much bigger effect. It's very, very hard to change the thickness. Actually, the UC Irvine group, when they say they vary the thickness, what they really do is a very smart design. They have this wedge-shaped sample. And they measure the same sample but at different points. That's how they change the sample thickness without changing the sample.
How strong the
intuitive effect is? Depending on the what type of physics are you asking. For example, if you're asking about the bulk conductivity, then it's zero. If you're asking the shift of the kinetic potential, it's probably 5 MeV. You shift kinetic potential by 5 MeV from the center of the gap. And the number of impurities is very low. However, there is another effect I should mention. For most of these samples, they are alumni due to the method they grow the sample. There is another method to grow this sample using floating zone. There will be no alumni impurity. But those alumni don't matter because if I measure transport, the alumni are just some local stuff. It cannot give you transport from one side to the other. But there is another growing method called floating zone growing method. Now there are previous studies using floating zone growing method. That's one where not an alumni property, but the transport curve is roughly speaking the same.
So how about interaction effects? Because you know this was basically a bent picture. You have DNF electrons.
Yes,
so
this is a very good question. So right now, qualitatively, there's no qualitative contribution from strong interaction. But quantitatively, there are many signatures. First, for example, if we look at the band structure, the fact that F band is very, very flat, this band is, not this one, let me go to the other one. Yeah, this band is very flat is actually a correlation effect. If I naively do LDA, the F band, the bandwidth would be a couple of electron volts. Okay, but if I turn on the large onset U, enhance the mass. This is a high standard heavy fermion story. And they can make the mass 100 times larger, make the band very, very flat. The band structure itself is a strong correlation effect. On top of that, I believe the bulk connectivity, the reason that bulk connectivity is so low is also a strongly correlated effect, related with the fact that there is a huge effective mass. So when you have a huge effective mass, it means the bulk is more robust against impurity. The reason is if you have an impurity and an electron, the electron will be bound near this impurity like a hydrogen atom. The effective mass tells you the radius of this hydrogen atom, the Bohr radius depending on the electron mass. When you have a very, very heavy electron, the radius is tiny. It means if you have impurity, it will bond the electron, it doped to the sample very close to itself. Because electrons are pinned very tightly to each impurity, it's very hard to hop from one impurity to another. Impurity gives you conduction comes from hopping electrons from one impurity to another. But if the radius is too small, it means overlap is tiny, electron cannot hop. That's probably the interaction effect. Another thing I didn't mention is the surface state of SMB6. The RPS data don't really see direct points. Actually, I have the figure here, but I didn't emphasize that. This one. So this is the surface state. This darker region is the bulk valence band. One don't see a direct point like crossing like this. One see actually these two lines, if you extrapolate them into the bulk region, they cross here, they cross at very low energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the Fermi velocity, the direct point is not in the gap, but deeply below in the valence band. That may be an interaction effect, actually. If I introduce interaction, it tends to enhance the Fermi velocity and push the direct points away from the computation. That's a known result from graphene studies.
Right, but EF could also be just away from the charge neutrality point. It's just in a free picture, right? I mean, it's, EF can be tuned.
In a free picture, if one assumes there is no fancy surface condition,
right.
Typical surface condition, then the direct point is always inside the gap. Of course, surface contribution can shape that, but the interaction effect is another possibility to understand this huge Fermi velocity. So this huge Fermi velocity is very, very large. It's about 1,000 times larger than the naive estimation. Naive estimation, I mean gap over pi over a, gap divided by pi over a. Typically, when we estimate the Fermi velocity of surface states, we estimate as gap over pi over a, because gap is a characteristic energy scale. Pi over a is a characteristic momentum scale. Energy over momentum gives new velocity. If you do that, this material, because the gap is very small, about 1,000 times smaller than semiconductor topological insulators, so one naively expects the Fermi velocity will be 1,000 times smaller. But the experiment measurement shows the Fermi velocity is the same, almost the same, and the weakly correlated topological insulator. So that 1,000 times enhancement of Fermi velocity, it may come directly from the interaction effect. So it's of course it's there are possible alternative explanations. For example, surface condition may enhance the Fermi velocity, but one thousand times that seems a little bit too large. Interaction changes the parameter by 100 times. It's not too crazy because for heavy fermion compound we know mass can be renormalized by two orders of magnitudes. Of course, it's still unclear, but you know, some of this quantitative feature shows strong correlation, signatures of strong correlation. But qualitatively, no. Qualitatively, this is still a surface conductor. It has Dirac cone, same as the non-interacting region. So this material is probably adiabatic connected to a weakly coated topological insulator. But the hope is, you know, since there is a long list of materials, maybe some other material shows surface symmetry breaking or even topological surface states. That's the hope. Right now, there's no any evidence beyond the non-interacting picture.
So if you do Bernstorff calculation, mm-hmm. that surface velocity is it's not renormalized.
If you do the Bernstorff calculation,
because there's flat line nearby,
right.
So there's possibility that the surface velocity is Hamiltonian like. So looks like you say it's not Hamiltonian like. There's no heaviness here. So.
This is actually not very strange because we know for a typical band, interaction enhance the mass, reduce from velocity.
Suppose we just do the free calculation.
Right.
We have flat F band, you have
right.
D band,
right.
We just add some
right.
calculation,
right.
we can
right.
have an D. If
right.
you just do this free
right.
calculation,
right. Right.
Dirac
point is always inside the gap.
Yes, but is that fast velocity or slow velocity?
It's a slow, it's very slow. It's the same as the estimation.
So it's really controlled by the candle temperature. So it's like a candle. This hybridization.
Right.
It's given. It's a kind of like a bandwidth.
It's a gap. It's a gap.
It's a
hybridization.
Bandwidth
right.
of
exactly.
A, of
exactly.
A, of
for
the
circuit. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So, but for the photon emission measurement, it is 1,000 times enhancement.
Photon emission and quantum oscillation both show 100 to 1,000 times enhancement. You know, this is nothing against topological theory. Topological theory says it's okay to be any value. But this is not totally crazy because if one naively adopts this free fermion calculation, this free fermion estimation of fermion velocity, because fermion velocity is so tiny, fine structure constant is huge. Fine structure constant here is 1,000 because the fermion velocity is 1,000 times smaller than graphene. If you based on this estimation. So for such a huge fine structure constant, it means interaction will definitely give some contribution.
Yeah, in the bulk, in the candle metal,
yeah.
we kind of say that the bulk is around, kind of like Fermi liquid, just with a very heavy mass.
Right.
And then there's the interaction band are weak, we don't worry about that.
Right.
And somehow here, the
it's exactly
the
opposite story.
Is very different.
It's exactly the opposite story.
Okay.
It's the Fermi velocity got enhanced, which means mass got reduced dramatically.
Yeah.
And after you reduce the mass dramatically, the fine structure constant becomes very small. So in this, after you renormalize this Fermi velocity, it becomes weakly correlated system again. Relatively weakly correlated. The fine structure becomes in order of one.
So basically, there's an issue about the whether one can really do some reliable calculation or
yeah.
estimate
yep.
to
yep.
say
yep.
that
yep.
interaction indeed make Fermi velocity so much bigger than the free electron
field. Right now, what I can tell you is for perturbative calculation, yes, it enhanced. But for perturbative calculation cannot be extrapolated to 1,000
yeah.
and alpha equals 1,000. So okay. and alpha equals 1,000, what will happen is there not quite clear yet. That's an open question.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a long way.
No, there's no further.